Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's kind of a nice energy here tonight. There's about the same number of monastics and lay people. And I wasn't quite sure if I was giving the talk or not tonight, and I guess it's kind of a good state to be in. So during the meditation, thinking, what am I going to say? And oh, well, I'm not sure if I'm giving it, so I just forget about it. Just going back and forth. Longpa's been doing a lot of teaching the last couple of days. Upasika Day was yesterday, and teaching through the day. I was tying up loose ends with work monk duties yesterday, getting ready for my retreat, a 2-week retreat tomorrow. So now we have the switchover for retreats. A few people coming off retreat, a few people going on to retreat. And it's nice to have that energy in the monastery with having people both on retreat and engaging in the regular daily schedule with the work period, morning and evening puja. Because there's this refrain in the suttas that if a bhikkhu is engaging in various work projects or tasks for the community, for the sake of the Sangha, that's meritorious, but they always keep in the back of their mind that when the opportunity presents itself, I will strive for stream entry, I strive for realizing the Dhamma. And so that's always kept in the back of the mind. So these retreats highlight that. And there's a lot happening. The reception hall is being built. There was a trenching project, some new water lines, electric lines being put in the ground. But then we have the meal, and then there's four people quietly coming in. Sometimes you don't even see them, don't even notice them. Because when one is on retreat, the energy goes quiet generally. So you might have not even see them or notice them, but they're quietly getting their food and disappearing. And so it's a good reminder, just that's what we're here for, that's what we're coming back to. And even if we're not in retreat, we can tap into that energy, that quiet energy, settled energy. We can always be recollecting it, recollecting peace, coming back to that. So one thing I've been reflecting on lately is Kantiparami, which is usually translated as patient endurance. It has a kind of a energy of non-anger, not getting angry in difficult situations, but also it's in Thai, otton. So it's a sense of continuing to move forward, a sense of endurance. And it's a very important quality to be cultivating in the practice, the Dhamma practice. Because invariably in our practice, obstacles arise. And when we keep precepts, whether it's the 5, 8, 10, or 227 precepts, it's inevitable that this is going to bring up heat in the mind. It's going to bring up, highlight different obstructions, bring up difficulties. And that quality of Kantiparami that's allowing us to face these things rather than turn away in distraction, which is what the way of the world is, turning to confusion, that's turning to the world. So we're turning away from the world, turning away from distraction, turning away from confusion. To be confused and to be distracted, that's what we call worldly. And to be unconfused, undistracted, peaceful, clear, that's Dhamma, that's a Dhamma practice. So we're practicing Dhamma in order to turn away from the world. We're looking for something else. Because having embraced the world for so long, it's like trying to sort things out in samsara is just endless and impossible. So when we get some inkling of that, some intuitive sense that sorting out samsara isn't going to work, then that means that we're someone who has little dust in our eyes. We can see clearly to that extent. But still, there's that confusion. It's not completely clear. Things aren't completely clear, but we see well enough to see the drawbacks of samsara. That's one way. In Thai, they translate the word samana as one who sees the drawbacks of samsara. So they're turning away from the world and looking towards something else, something that's peaceful, something that has finality. So looking through some of Ajahn Chah's teachings today, just reviewing, and Lungpu Cha always speaks in a way that the Dhamma is something that has finality, and the world is something where it's endless, it keeps going on and on, the world of dukkha. And no matter what kind of happiness or dissatisfaction or suffering or agony or joy, whatever we experience as far as the range of feeling and emotion, it's always just that much, and it arises and passes away, but there's no finality to it, so it always leads to something else. But with the Dhamma practice, the Kruba Ajahn's teaching, leading to the ending of defilements, the ending of all the mental obscurations, that there are beings, the Buddha and the great teachers, the great disciples, and more recently the great Kruba Ajahn's, our own teachers. There are beings who don't have defilements, who have compassion for the world. And so they're teaching from a place free of defilements. The suttas, the teaching of the Buddha was free from defilements. And so the speech of the Buddha is speech that is completely pure, completely free of defilement. And those are the teachings that we have. And for those of us who are still stuck with the defilements, then those teachings are grating and sometimes difficult to hear. And especially this day and age, like Lungpo Pasano was saying the other day, I think at tea time, that we could basically say anything and just say the Buddha under it and just say the Buddha said that. You know? So we have this tendency to apply our delusions to the teachings. And that's exactly the opposite of what the Buddha said, is practicing Dhamma according to the Dhamma. So if we're applying our delusions to the Dhamma, then we're not practicing Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma. But if we're making an honest assessment of ourselves and seeing, okay, this is where this and that defilement are still present, there's greed here, there's anger there, this is making a very honest assessment, this is exactly where I'm at. And so then we start where we are, then that's practicing Dhamma according to Dhamma. That's practicing Dhamma according to truth of the way things are, rather than denying what's there because that's not who I am, rather than just looking away or seeking some sort of distraction just like we've always done before. But it's just making an honest assessment and using that otton, that kanti parami, to really go into it, really, really be with it. Not to run away through sleep or distraction or some sort of mental habit that just turns away from looking at these things. But that's the practice, and it's difficult. I remember 10 years ago, 2004, Buddhist monastic conference at Land of the Medicine Buddha, and I'd been a monk for a couple of years at that time, and went down with, I think it was with Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Sudanto, and I was the kind of junior monk along, just upatak, helping look after the seniors. And I remember there was some very, since I came here, I've always been very impressed with the senior monks and nuns at City of 10,000 Buddhas. So at that Buddhist monastic conference, there was a particular senior bhikkhuni, Dharma Master Hung Chur, and she's now been a bhikkhuni for about 40 years, maybe more than 40 years. She was one of the five original disciples of Master Xuanhua when he came to America in the early 60s. And I remember getting this rare opportunity to talk with her. It was one evening, everybody was just chatting, hanging out. There wasn't much of a schedule, and she was sitting in a chair. And so I just thought, I'm going to take this opportunity, because they usually don't, they're very strict in their precepts, and they usually don't speak with men. But this was kind of more of a loose occasion. And so I took the opportunity to go sit on the floor and ask her some questions. And she was sitting in a chair. And various things I wanted to ask her, various curiosities I had about the City of 10,000 Buddhas community. And so one of the things I was asking her was about sitter's practice. I was curious about how they trained for it. I knew that she had cultivated that practice. And so she was kind of telling me about how they had trained for it, and like how they would lock each other up in wooden boxes that you couldn't stretch your legs out in San Francisco at Gold Mountain Monastery in the 60s, and your friend had to come unlock you in the morning and or before the morning chanting, and how they kind of trained in that way. So she was telling me this, and then I was also asking her, like, how do you cultivate patient endurance and how do you overcome difficulties? Because I felt like for myself at the time, and you know, I still feel this way now, but even it was more prominent even back then. It's like just getting hammered by the defilements. I just feel like it's just they don't let up. Just feel like I'm just getting buffeted back and forth. And is there any end to this? And her response was kind of like, "Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, that's good." And then Lungbor Pasano related to us after that Buddhist monastic conference that Dharma Master Hung Chur had approached him and said, "Oh, it sounds like the training is good there at Bayagiri." And he said, "Yeah, it's not normal that she praises people, you know, that, but I think it's because I told her I was suffering so much and just getting hammered, and she really spoke in praise of that." And she's also known for being quite having a lot of. She's the only one who Master Xuanhua ever told, out of all of his disciples, she's the only one that he ever told to take it easy, to kind of ease up in her practice. And so the Lungpor Cha would talk like this, Lungpor Mun as well, like when you become a religious seeker or you really come to the practice in earnest, then it's like you're being forged, and you're keeping the precepts, so that's already really questioning, calling the defilements into question to a certain extent. And then the great Krupa Ajahns are also using various skillful means to heat us up. So you have various stories of Lungpo Cha, you know, testing Lungpor Sumedho, and you know, like heating him up, you know, talking for a long time after the Padimokkha, or just really heating up his disciples in various ways. So we're like iron, we're being heated up, and things are getting hot, things are being called into question. And so the iron is being heated up, and various impurities are being burned, and it's getting hotter and hotter. And then when you're really, really hot, really glowing, really red hot, then you get beaten. You just get hammered. And then when you get hammered a number of times from one side, then they flip you over and then hammer you from the other side. And then it starts to cool off a bit. The iron starts to cool off, so then it just gets shoved back into the coals, and then beaten from both sides again. Till eventually, then you have this beautiful gleaming sword, this beautiful piece of steel, which is sharp and shining and cool, and it doesn't become that way without being forged, without being tempered in that way. So for myself, when I'm undergoing difficulties, I like to think of it that way, like it's just it's really not oneself who's suffering, it's the defilements, the greed, the anger that can't vent itself, the greed that can't fulfill itself. This is what's being frustrated. If we just follow it, follow the way of the world, it never really lashes out, it never really has to come get us. But we call it into question, we start trying to overcome it, we start trying to train the mind in a way that's more and more peaceful, so then it lashes out, then it comes out for us. So it's just critical to cultivate that sense of kanti-parami, to be able to endure these things and not give up, not throw in the towel once things start to get difficult, because they definitely will, unless you're some sort of tulku or incarnate or some sort of extraordinary being, which most of us aren't. And that quality of patient endurance as well is causing us to just push the envelope a little bit in our practice. And I find this is a good thing to talk about on the Wan Pra, because we're about to be holding our meditation vigil, staying up late, staying up past 3 a.m. And this is not something that normal people do. We do this about once a week. And it's tough for most people. Just staying up late, just pushing the envelope just a little bit. Or it doesn't even have to be on the Wan Pra, but getting back to our kuti after the meal, and one is tired. I find I'm usually pretty tired walking up the hill after eating. Body is physically tired just from the walk up the hill, and then there's the drowsiness connected with having had the meal. But then just making that effort to get out onto the walking meditation path, and just questioning that tiredness, just that little bit. And the walking meditation, it doesn't even have to be for that long. It is okay to take a short rest, but just really giving attention, giving importance to that quality of patient endurance, and doing the meditation when those states come up. Or when it's later at night, one gets back to one's kuti rather than just flopping down out of exhaustion, just taking a moment to settle the mind, doing some walking meditation, doing just even if just a little bit of sitting meditation before lying down in the evening. Because it's really just the body needs a rest. So when the body needs a rest, then we lie down, we sleep. But the defilements aren't ever going to rest. They aren't ever going to give us a break until we have insight into them. So just keeping that in mind, anytime we do rest, the defilements, they're coming up in our dreams. They're coming up in all sorts of ways. When a monk in Thailand takes a rest, they call it jumwat. Jumwat is like setting aside the duties. We don't say bai non, which is usually what the ordinary way to say, I'm going to go lie down. But we say jumwat, which is like temporarily setting aside the duties, temporarily setting aside the mindfulness, which will then pick up quickly when we wake up, when we get up. When Longpo Tui was visiting Wat Nanachat, I wasn't there, but I heard this story that he was demonstrating to some of the Nanachat monks how to get up in the morning. And he was saying, as soon as I get up, and he's kind of demonstrating, he's lying down, and he said, as soon as I get up, and he jumps up and puts his legs into full lotus as fast as he can. He said, that's how you get up. Just get up as fast as you can. Because it's easy in the morning to kind of hit the snooze button over and over again. And then kind of it's 4:45. Oh, I got to be at the meditation by 5. But then if you're able to get up at 4, then it's like you have time to establish some mindfulness, maybe do some stretching, do some yoga, qigong. Yeah, make your way to the meditation. It's not rushed. But it's like getting through that barrier of getting up. It's like the skill of getting up, the yoga of getting up in the morning. And patient endurance also allows us to keep going when we make mistakes. So it's inevitable that we make mistakes. We're kept to quite a high standard here in the monastery. And so mistakes inevitably happen, and it's good to be able to deal with them in the proper way. And so when one has something pointed out to one, or one realizes one has made a mistake in some way, maybe a broken precept or some other type of mistake, then we just make a determination. That wasn't for my own benefit, that wasn't for the benefit of others. And then we say, well, I'll restrain myself in the future. So it's like when we're bowing during the evening puja, and then kayena wa chetasa wa, by body, speech, or mind. Kayena wa vachena wa chitena wa. So it's like by body, speech, or mind, for whatever wrong action I've committed towards Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, may my acknowledgement of fault be accepted, that in the future there may be restraint towards Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So incredibly wholesome, just making that intention clear on a daily basis. And for the monastics here, we have forms that we follow in the Padimokkha, confessing offenses, making them known, making them clear. Also during the Vasa period, studying the Vinaya precepts, protocols, Kor Wat, which is the monastic etiquette. And so there is the 227 rules of the bhikkhus, but also there's a lot more. There's the Kor Wat, the monastic etiquette, the monastic form. There's also thousands of minor protocols in the Chulavaga. And so there's lots of ways we can mess up or go wrong, but it's learning how to hold these things in a way that is wholesome and use them for cultivation and training. It's not easy to master the Vinaya. There's a Pali word, sila sampanno, which is like a perfection of sila, or you're holding it in the perfect way. The Buddha was vijja charana sampanno, perfect in knowledge and conduct. So not only is the knowledge or the liberation perfect, but the conduct, the external manifestation, is perfect as well. And that perfection can only happen not through a rigid adhering to all the rules, the letter of the rules, but it happens through a full realization of the spirit of what the rules are for. And then you can be sila sampanno. And it's not easy. Like, we have this one rule about disrespect is a pachitya offense. Disrespect is to be confessed. And this one is very difficult to keep in a perfect way all the time, because we have a pachitya, which is an offense to be confessed at the Padimokkha, but also there's the derived offenses, which is dukkata, which is a lesser offense. It's like inappropriate or not to be done. And so, see, the pachitya offense for us is disrespect. So if we have something pointed out to us by another bhikkhu, it's disrespect, responding in a disrespectful way to that other bhikkhu, or responding in terms of disrespect to the rule. You know, I'm not going to keep that rule. Or who are you to tell me that? You know, you have some serious emotional problems, you know, you need to look at. Or so it's like that responding in a disrespectful way, even if that person pointed out something not correct to us, still responding in a disrespectful way is to be confessed. That's one aspect of it. And then there's the derived offenses, which is even if a layperson tells us something that even if it doesn't pertain to the rules, but points something out to us, even if they're not right, even if it's not correct, still to respond in a disrespectful way is a dukkha, is a lesser offense. And so to really keep this particular rule in the spirit and the letter completely, one has to be incredibly humble, because I know for myself, it's I haven't, this rule has been very, very difficult. And but then you just confess it, just keep working away at it, keep being, you know, reestablishing that mindfulness, because one has to have incredible mindfulness and be incredibly humble in order to not even commit a dukkha under this rule. And so that's like learning the art of the Vinaya, because it really is an art. There's no, one cannot just follow the letter of it all the time and be okay just by rigidly doing that, because there are also certain circumstances where the letter gets shifted around a bit based on circumstances, like if it's going to create disharmony in the community. Sometimes the Buddha would say, well, you don't need to keep this minor rule, because it might, if it's going to create a schism or create disharmony or create a split in the community. So there's certain circumstances where you do that as well. And so Lungpu Cha is studying all these rules, and there's a story of, that's one of the stories of him on Tudong and seeking out Lungpu Mun and spending two or three days with Lungpu Mun. And one of the questions he asked was, there's all these rules, and it doesn't seem like I could possibly remember all of these rules and practice them according to the letter of the rule. And Lungpu Mun just said, just cultivate Hiriyotapa, and these are the protectors of the world. It's usually translated as shame and fear of wrongdoing, but I've heard recently, like, Lungpa Sumedho had a different take. It was like a principle and integrity, or like
self-respect and decorum.
And so that has kind of a different feeling than shame and fear. And so one has those qualities of Hiriyotapa, and the rules come more naturally. It's not that one doesn't study the rules or try to follow the letter of them, but with a sense of self-respect and decorum and keeping that in mind, it's going to be much easier to know what the spirit of the rules is. It's really amazing that we have these teachings of the Krupa Ajahns, because they, from Lungpu Mun down to his disciples and Ajahn Chah and all of his disciples, quite amazing that we have these kind of examples to follow. And we're benefiting in ways which aren't always perceptible, not easy to see, because the compassion or the pure intentions of the Krupa Ajahns is something which is completely unworldly. So they're not teaching us for any sense of gain, any sense of praise, any sense of honor, not any worldly reason, but they give us the teachings freely out of compassion, out of just a genuine wish to see other people benefit from them. The Krupa Ajahns themselves having received the great benefit of the Buddha's teachings. And so we're recipients of that, but also they're helping us in other ways, in that when we were in their presence or just around the very senior monks, the Mahateras, the great teachers in our tradition, then automatically we're more restrained. The Hiriyotapa goes up when we're around them. Ajahn Jodhi Polo was showing me something from the Visuddhimagga earlier today. It was a story about a certain monk who was living in solitude, practicing, and he'd been practicing there for some time, and then he had decided he was going to go spend the Vasa somewhere else. And there were these devas living at that spot. And so this monk had the ability to speak with devas, see the devas. And so this deva came to him and said, "Why are you leaving? I'll be very sad if you leave." And this monk said, "Well, what's the big deal? You're a deva. Why will you be sad if I leave?" And he said, "Well, before you came here, me and the other devas always argued and quarreled with each other. But then when you came here, we stopped arguing and quarreling and we live in harmony. And when you leave, we're just going to start arguing and quarreling again. So would you please stay here so we don't start arguing and quarreling?" So the deva could see that. And it made me think too of Yatiko. It's like, "Oh, is there any differences you're noticing? Or, wow, the lay people act a lot different when they're not around the monks." Sorry, I can only say that because there's just as many lay people as monks here tonight. So yeah, developing these qualities of patient endurance, just remembering that it is difficult to cultivate Hiriyotapa, cultivate Kantiparami. Remembering that in our Dhamma practice, this is a forge, and the mind gets heated up, we get beaten back and forth, but that's okay. We stick with it. We become better, become brighter. The wisdom gets sharper. But if we don't keep the practice in the proper perspective, that what we're doing it for, that we've received the compassion from the Kruba Ajahns, and we're doing this for the sake of liberation from the defilements, liberation from the khandhas, and we're doing this for the sake of giving up every kind of worldliness and attaining clarity, peace. But it takes work, it takes endurance. And sometimes we might get peaceful and things might seem good, and then it's anicca. The defilements come back. They come back again and again. So they're finding ways, finding different angles to get at us. We might have some sort of experience of samadhi, just very, very peaceful. And then it's so brilliant, it's so different from anything we've experienced before, that one might think, "Oh, that must be stream entry, that must be liberation." And then, of course, that's the vipassana upakilesa coming in, is the defilement of insight. So every insight we have, Mara is right there waiting, like, "Yes, yes, you are enlightened, yeah, that was a great, you know." Or you have some sort of vision or nimitta, you say, Mara's right there, "Yes, yes, that was it, that was stream entry, and you should go start teaching now, you should also tell everyone about it." And so it's defilements of insight. That's one great boon of having teachers as well, is that gets, that usually doesn't fly in the monastery. But it flies out in the world. You know, you can go be a Dhamma teacher, you can make a lot of money, but usually doesn't fly in the monastery. So this patient endurance, and also Master Xuanhua used this phrase, like a long enduring mind. And so we make various mistakes, we fall down, we just keep getting up, we just keep keep moving on, having a long enduring mind, having that intention that no matter how difficult it gets, there's no giving up. So people come and go, you know, you see your friends maybe leave the monastery or disrobe, but it's like making that intention, okay, well, you know, this is we have our examples, we have the Krubajans, and this is possible, this can be done. That just that long enduring mind, that long vision, long term outlook. And this is a lifestyle. It's practice made into a lifestyle. And it's not just having like one blazing insight, but it's learning how to live according to Dhamma, learning how to live according to the teachings. Our progress, you know, as long as we're keeping the precepts and doing our meditation and doing the practice, on a certain level, it doesn't really matter what's happening. It's like the analogy in the suttas, the carpenter's hammer. He has a rubber handle on his mallet, and over years and years of use, it starts to get worn away, but he doesn't know. Only so much has been worn away, only so much has been rubbed away. But then, one day, after many decades perhaps, that hammer is worn away, rubbed away, rubbed through, and then one knows it's completely worn away, it's completely worn through. Or like I was visiting my parents recently, and my father has this mallet that he's used for his wood sculpting, and he was using this same mallet when I was in high school, he was using the same mallet for his wood sculpting, and I always knew that he used that mallet. Just a simple wooden dowel with a big block of wood on top of it, and he's used that for years and years for his wood sculpting, and it started out, it had this little indention in it, and my most recent trip to visit my parents, I looked and he still had that mallet there and he's still using it, but now it's the handle and it just has this little nub on the top. The whole thing is gone and it's just been slowly beaten away on the chisel, and that made me think of that sutta with the carpenter's hammer. So it's like years of just tapping away at greed, tapping away at anger, tapping away at delusion, you know, tapping away at our cultivation of mindfulness, tapping away at all of our practices, at loving kindness, and tapping away at the cultivation of the asubha kamatan, the reflection on the unattractive nature of the body. And we're just constantly tapping away at the practice, tapping away at obstacles and defilements that come up. And it's so easy for the old conditioning to come up and for us to lose heart. It's like the strong defilements might come up and then we identify with them. So, no, I can't do it. I can't. It was possible for Lungpu Man, possible for Lungpu Cha, the Krubajans, but not me, not pathetic little me. I can't do it. So we just keep tapping away, Like there's this wonderful sutta, like the Buddha just talking about developing patient endurance and talking about the bhavana. And you just establish mindfulness on the breath again and again. And you just meditate again and again. And you just cultivate samadhi again and again. And then one isn't born again and again. So here at Abhayagiri, we keep the wanpra again and again. And I think that's enough. This evening. Sadhu